So thinking we're here this little minute, this little hour, kind of like a flash of lightning. Make the most of it. We're going to listen to a few thoughts, look into our minds, contemplate. Sow a few seeds in the mind, because every thought counts. This is very much the Buddhist approach, don't go astray. We're produced by our thoughts. So thank you, God. So that we can develop our motivation, we can develop our amazing potential for our benefit. Also because we live in this crazy world together for the sake of others as well. So I think that's why we're sitting here. Okay, so let's first, I mean, we say meditate, like I said 2 days ago, maybe yesterday as well. It's interesting, the Tibetan verb to meditate, surprising to us, because we have many very firm concepts of what we think meditation means. Usually kind of either relaxation or closing your eyes or something kind of clearly vague, you know, something mystical. It's really rather foolish. It's not like that. It's a very practical activity. So the verb gom, the Tibetan word to meditate, translates as to become familiar with, to familiarize your mind with. What? 2 things. Wisdom and virtue. Wisdom and goodness. That's it. This whole Buddhist idea is based on this goal, the end result. This word, the etymology of the word Buddha is super tasty. Buddha implies the utter eradication from one's mind of all neuroses, all fears, all ego, all nonsense, you know. And the second syllable, da, implies the development to perfection of everything else, the goodness, clarity, kindness, love, compassion, etc. I mean, this is a kind of quite shocking thought, really. There's no equivalent view in modern psychology or neuroscience. It sounds nutty, you know. But this is the Buddhist, this is the Buddhist approach. What the Buddha, this person called Buddha, has found to be possible. He did the job himself, and he says, here's my methodology, over to you. So we need to learn then to know about the mind, what it is, how it functions. We learn to become super familiarize our mind with it as it is now and how to transform it, how to reconfigure it, how to unpack and unravel all the thoughts and feelings and emotions and turn them into the mind of a blissfully wise, happy, content, fulfilled, compassionate person, Buddha. As someone ever says, we can mold our mind into any shape we like. The mind is Buddha's expertise, guaranteed. So before we do some, you know, thinking about this, familiarizing our mind with a few things, let's get the body organized. So because we're so addicted to our body, so overwhelmed by the presence of our body, we even think I am, this is it, I'm just the body, big love of me, plodding through life. The body doesn't meditate, the mind does. So nevertheless, there's, you know, both the great meditators over the centuries have found certain positions be conducive, most conducive, to doing the job well, familiarizing our mind with wisdom and virtue. There's about 18 points. Let's just check them. So first of all, you know, all the this position you see in the pictures and the statues is, you know, people sitting across full lotus across cross-legged position, the right in front, the leg up, and each on the other side. Well, that's found by, over the centuries by all the great meditators. To be perfect way to sit because, it, you know, when you meditate for a long time, you don't topple over. And at the subtler level of our mind and our wind energy, subtler energies can be very aligned. Some great meaning in it. So the Dalai Lama said that we can start our session like that. That's very auspicious. So if you can't sit that way, have one leg on the other side. If you can't sit that way, all your cross-legged. If you can't sit that way, in a chair. So if you're in a chair like me, then don't flop into the back. Sit up straight. And your feet firmly on the ground. Then you can stay upright, stay stable. It's interesting. The next is your hands. This is a classic kind of mudra or gesture. Left underneath, right on top, thumbs touching like this. If you'd like, if not, just put them on your lap, relax. They then talk about your shoulders being upright, but relaxed. So then I think the whole body. Flop your muscles, but keep your bones upright, your skeleton upright, but relax. We tense our muscles a lot. drop the muscles, especially the abdomen, it was tense there. Then your head, finally. Chin tucked in a little, head slightly tilted forward. Helps the mind not be agitated. Your head is thrust back to be agitated. Jaw relaxed. So oddly, lips slightly apart. And the tip of the tongue resting just under the palate, behind the palate. And this has been found by all the great meditators that it prevents you from having to dribble while you're meditating for a long time. It sounds rather silly, but it's really practical, you know. So even though we might have to meditate for 5 minutes, it's a good to emulate the position. Tongue behind the top teeth, just near the palate. Breathing through your nose. And then your eyes looking down, as if you're looking along your nose. Again, the great meditators have found that if they're going to meditate day and night, especially during the day, you know, in order not to have the mind space out, if they keep their eyes open so the light can come in and keep the mind sharp. I think most of us don't have good concentration, so maybe we keep them closed, get distracted. So your legs, your back, your hands, your shoulders, your chin, jaw, tongue, eyes. Settle, and now settle into this position, very unselfconscious, and forget about it. So we'll first do a little meditation. There's two kinds of meditation in Buddhism, thousands of techniques, but there's two modes. And the first one that we tend to think of as meditation is a technique where you consciously not following the thoughts. You don't try to spot them or make them go away. You can't do that. But there's a conscious effort to not follow the thoughts, not to be absorbed in the thoughts. We try to cultivate concentration. It's this brilliant psychological study invented by these genius Indians more than 3,000 years ago. Still a living, real, extant technique that's crucial to the Buddhist practice eventually to get this concentration. And the other kind of meditation, it's known as insight. There's a really good word in English. In other languages, it's a bit abstract. In English, it's sort of insight, inner seeing, when you get something. You're thinking about a problem in daily life, and you go, oh, I get it. That's an insight. It's a lovely word. So what are we trying to get insight into? Virtue and wisdom. I mean, essentially. There's a whole methodology there of how to get insight. But it's dependent upon the concentration. This is not religious, this is practical. If you're trying to make a cake, you can't concentrate for more than a minute, you'll never get a cake. The concentration is kind of crucial. That's the one, the mindfulness technique to refer to. So we'll do one of those for just a few minutes. Quality. It's better to do 3 minutes quality than 5 minutes, 10 minutes spacing out. Because meditation isn't relaxation. It isn't to make the thought go away. It isn't get some kind of vision or good feeling or experience. Not like that. This first kind of concentration, it's like training. You're training your mind to stay on one thing. Of course it won't stay because you're not used to it. So you bring it back. So 50 minutes, 50 times in 1 minute, you have to bring your attention back to the object, in this case, the breath. We're going to focus on the breath. 50 times a minute, you bring it back. That's a good meditation. For 1 minute spacing out, let's release. So, okay, we're going to just watch the breath. Use the breath as our focal point. So the breath in particular here will be this sensation at the tip of your nose. So just take a couple of breaths and locate that sensation. It's a general area where you feel the breath touching the nostrils. It's a bit different when you breathe in and out. That general area, that's the focal point. That's what we've got to pay attention to. Just locate it first. Okay, having identified it, we're now going to train ourselves to save it. And of course, you won't. Don't be surprised. Don't be depressed. Like someone said, oh, I tried to meditate once, it didn't work. You know, you've got a patient, please. So the real point is you've got another part of your mind. One part of the mind is called attention, and that's a bit doing the looking. Another part is called mindfulness, which is like a part of my life, another, watching attention like a book. Attention is like a key. The second it wanders off, mummy brings it back to the breath. But mindfulness brings it back. So just 2 bits of your mind, thinking about that. So it's very practical. So with strong determination for about 3 minutes, 3 quality minutes, pay attention to that breath. Just breathe in and breathe out and you stay attention. Now the thoughts are going to be there. Let them be there. Let them come and let them go. That's the skill. Don't pay attention to them. You can't stop them. You can't drive them away. That's silly. But you don't pay attention to them. You pay attention to the breath instead. With determination, watch your breath. Stay alert, don't space out. Just watch the breath. Trust the breath. Stay sharp. Don't sink into the thoughts on a sponge. Stay sharp. Another minute. Just stay sharp, stay focused. Yep, thoughts coming down. Okay, very nice now. We've got 3 or 4 minutes actually. 3 or 4 minutes, and look what happened. Because we're really making an effort. Every 7 minutes. You know? So you can see even a few minutes of this, really effortful. Knowing exactly what you're doing, not trying to space out, not trying to make the thoughts go away, not trying to relax, not trying to have a vision. It's a simple technique, it's practical. You're training yourself to stay on one thing. That's it. So even if there's an effort to do it, already it has been done. How benefit, you know? So okay. Let's look at this business. Of these four immeasurable thoughts, which I've said there before, this is becoming a really interesting aspect of all the teachings. You know, these techniques we're trying to use to help us break down the barriers between self and other. The wisdom work is the nuts and bolts of the beginnings of that job. Seeing all the obstacles in the mind that makes you miserable, the voices of ego, the attachment, the fears and neuroses, the jealousy, the worries, the anxiety, the depression, the arrogance, the low self-esteem, we know all those. They're the obstacles. They make miserable. They exaggerate everything. They weaken our good qualities. And they separate us from others, you know. Because your lesson learned, you become more content, you become more fulfilled, you become more joyful, quite literally. Buddha's method for getting happy, basically. And you stop harming others, and then you start opening your eyes and realize, oh my goodness, we're all the same age. Beginning of feeling connected to the world. Not depressed and separate from it, not angry and separate from it, not jealous and separate from it. Not low self-esteem and separate from it, not arrogant and separate from it. They're all symptoms of being separate from everybody else. It's more isolated than me, you know. But we're trying to kind of perk up and keep the point. It's just neurotic and miserable person gets sad. Now, feel guilty, Buddha's pointing out, this is why we suffer, this is why we suffer, and this is why we make a mess and harm others. As we begin to get a handle on all that, then we can start to, you know, connecting. We're already breaking down the barriers to see someone else. Now we proactively, in the compassion, we continue to work on our mind, but proactively try to get close and break down the barriers, try to know how to help us. First is we start to harm them. Now we actually begin to tentatively know how to help them. Because working on your own mind, less than all the rubbish, helps you become more fulfilled and content, but also enables you to see others more clearly. Because then they cause us to see. We see with a neurotic, we see the world through their lenses. And so we just see it ugly, beautiful, this, that, up and down like yo-yos. Not much reality there. So now we've lessened them with the neurosis. We've controlled the servants of the neuroses, the body and speech, some kind of semblance of discipline and fulfillment and contentment. And very connected to others. Yeah, try to develop and perfect the positive qualities. The essence of which you can say, I'm not compassion, as we talked the last 2 days. So love, as I said, is the delight that others are happy, the delight, the wish that they be happy, which we grow and cultivate, and eventually it manifests as genuine affection. We know we have that for some people. As we discussed, we only have it for the famous, for our beloveds. You know? We don't have it for the ones who are mean to us. We don't have it for those who neither help us nor harm us. The enemies of the strangers, and we only have love for a few people. And then compassion. Wish others don't suffer, wish others want others to be free from suffering. So this compassion, we have a brave attitude of the body suffers. Sanskrit word referring to these marvelous practitioners who are really on track on this path. The brave attitude is one of its five responsibilities. Like as if you're the mother for every being. You know it's your job. You don't need to be told. A mother sees her baby drowning and she has incredible compassion. Oh my God, look at that suffering. But she doesn't look around and wonder who's going to save her baby. Even if she can't swim, she's right there. She knows it's her job. That's the attitude of the bodhisattva, which sounds exhausting. I mean, just having that responsibility for one or two people is tiring. Imagine trying to have it for everybody. And that's where this first of these four immeasurable thoughts that we discussed on the first day come in. This equanimity, the basis, the foundation upon which we can then grow stably. Love for not just a few, but for all. It sounds shocking, but it's possible. So we're using logic in these contemplations to deconstruct ego's misconception. So now we told you at the first day, equanimity, the first of these four. And the second one is the second, which is another suffering. We didn't need to go into much detail about that. Let's do that. And the third one is love, which is wanting people to be happy. I think we talked about that one. So let's go back to the second one, which is may. I'll say the four again, just to remind us. Not of the extensive version. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings could abide in equanimity, free of attachment, anger, and indifference. May they abide so. And now this brave attitude of the Bodhisattva, I will make this happen. So of course, all these things we're trying to get for ourselves first. So this is this more marvelous one of where others have it, and I'm going to make it happen. The assumption being we know how. And then finally, the fourth thought in the of the first one, please bless me to be able to do this. And the second one, how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings could be free of suffering and its causes. May they be free. I will make this happen. Please bless me to be able to do this. We're talking to the Buddha, like, you know, if you have a visualization, you might think of the Buddha there, trying to get inspiration from the Buddha. You've got to do it. You kind of feel inspired by the Buddha. Please bless me to do it. May I have the courage to do it. And the third one, how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings could have happiness and its causes. So generally here, this is like regular happiness, getting all the nice things. And then the fourth one is the happiness of freedom from all the suffering. We maybe will discuss that. So this one, and the lovers of it, sometimes if we say this, we should say the happiness of enlightenment. So may they have happiness of enlightenment and its causes. May they have them. I will make this happen. Please, Buddha, bless me to be able to do this. And now this fourth one says how wonderful it will be. Well, sentient beings were never parted from higher rebirths, meaning human, etc. You know, as Buddha said, we go from life to life. And liberation's excellent bliss. We'll discuss this. May they have them. May they never be separate. I will make this happen. Please, Buddha, bless me to be able to do this. So these are amazing aspirations. Many of the prayers we do are like this. They're aspirations. They're thoughts. They're like positive thinking, you know? Because everything exists on the tip of the wish. For the same Tibetan, as long as I translate it. Then this is the start of the process. We have a thought first. Everything exists with a thought. If you want an ice cream, there's no way you're going to lift your legs and get into the car and buy it. You don't have the first thought, I want an ice cream. Everything starts with that, intention. If you want a boss inside here, intention, the first step. So we did a bit yesterday about that we try to want others to be happy, not just their friends. So the suffering one is important to understand because the Buddha's analysis of suffering is much more vast and shockingly so than the view we have now. So it's important to understand this. So when we say suffering now, what we see is other people, it's other people. No, ourselves first. It's when bad things happen, isn't it? It's very simple. It's when the bad things happen. You might say it's suffering, or I've got suffering when you just hurt your toe. But it's a moment of suffering, definitely. It's when the bad things happen. When your husband leaves you, when you get sick, when you get poor, when you lose your job. Look at it. Look at every example it is in your life. Everybody has moments of these since we were born. It's part of the deal, you know. We mean that is suffering. And so a simple way of putting it is, it's what you don't want. It's what you don't want. So putting it more precisely using Buddha's analysis, it's what attachment doesn't want. So that gets us to understand what attachment is. And this, if we don't understand this, we do not understand Buddhism. This is huge for the Buddhist analysis, for the Buddhist view of the mind. This is about thousands of ideological unhappy. I face fear-based states of mind, the source of our pain and why we harm others. And we have lots and lots of these marvelous positive ones. And the crucial job is we have to distinguish between them. So we can lessen and eventually long-term get rid of the first lot and grow to perfection the second lot. This is quite unique to the Buddha. We do not talk like this in modern psychology. It sounds very judgmental. It sounds kind of weird, you know. So it's quite precisely what he's saying. So there's some neurotic states in one. He narrows them down. They're all subsumed in the three. You read any Buddhist book, you're going to hear the three poisons. These three toxic emotions are saying. And there's such cute words. Attachment, aversion, or anger, and ignorance. Simple words. You've got to know what it means by this. And there's a hierarchical relationship. The root of them is very quite subtle to us. We won't even go into it here. Ignorance, the main ignorance is referred to as primordially deep assumption of a separate concrete solid set in stone, little me in there somewhere. It's very subtle. We don't notice it. That's the main one. So its main voice is attachment to get with that little audience. And that's multifaceted, that attachment. Primordial level of it is dissatisfaction. We're born with it. Primordial feeling, just set myself dissatisfied, which means I haven't got what I want. I haven't got enough. And when it's really serious, it's I am not enough. I am not enough. Then because we don't have enough, or I'm not enough, we don't have enough, let's say, the next level of this attachment is this emotional hunger, this hankering for what? Something necessarily out there. As soon as you open your eyes in the morning, there's out there. Your five senses contact out there. And that's what we think life is. We think out there somewhere is happiness, and out there somewhere is suffering. We spend our lives trying to get the happiness and avoid the suffering. So it's kind of scary. So we're constantly hungering after something out there. This is the grossest level of attachment. Such that when I get it, it'll fill me up and make the test satisfaction go away. And it's all just assumed, no articulate. Oh, I think I'll go and find happiness. Stuff like that. It's very primordial. That's the grossest level of it. The sensory objects. So then when you get the object, let's say the chocolate cake, the key function of the attachment is to exaggerate the deliciousness of the object and to grossly exaggerate the job of that object to make me happy. The more hungry you are emotionally, the more divine the object looks, the more fanatical we become to get it. So we become a control freak. That's what a control freak is, getting what my attachment wants. So, of course, it's not just the objects of the five senses. More broadly, it's, you know, it can be making everything out there how I think it should be. We talk about control freak. It's a great term. Making everything out there perfect. So whether you're in the house, you know, obsessively making everything perfect. If you're in a group of people, making sure they all do and say and sit where you want them to be. It's control freak. We're all like that. We all have that. Or getting, you know, maybe you're attached to a few more clothes, maybe, but you're totally attached to your views, for example. You know, what you think is right. All different attachments, the same mind, with all bunch of different objects, according to our personality. So basically, attachments is primordial infant in there, very fragile, this neurotic food junkie that's frantic every second to get what I want. Which equates to the nice things. Nice things, by definition, is what I think is nice. So that's what it spends its time doing. So if we mainly got attachment, you'd be one. You'd be a psychotic. You'd be what the world calls a narcissistic sociopath. All these Greek words we put on mental states, you know. But if you're saving grace is your love, your compassion, your intelligence, your kindness, the more of this, the more that subdues the attachment, softens it. It kind of takes a back place. The more fanatic attachment is, the more vampirish and maniac and harmful you are. Getting what you want. Really, it sounds quite brutal, but that's what it is. Now the key is when attachment doesn't get what it wants, which is 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 moments a day, that's the third voice. The millisecond attachment is thwarted. That's aversion, like a panic attack. Oh my God. So attachment kind of goes towards something, and aversion is a shock, like an electric shock that makes you want to go away from it. Depending on your personality, there's aversion, so panic attack. Like John McEnroe said, what did he say? That is not possible. But that one is always probably the same. Don't you know that? The tennis player, yeah. John McEnroe, isn't it? Panic attack, you don't do what you want. We can see it, isn't it? Very fascinating. I swear to you, if we could understand attachment and aversion a little bit deeper, just a little bit deeper past the words, we'd be brilliant, genius, joyful, marvelous, happy, fulfilled human beings. But to say that in modern psychotherapy or neuroscience, I think you're a maniac that blocks you up. But someone said these two. And then these two, these three, the one underneath, as Lynn Rinpoche says, they were talking Buddhism about 84,000 erotic sex at night. I always ask the Geshe's, what text will I find it in? They say, you won't. I'm determined to find it somewhere. It has to be this map of the mind, you know. 84,000 erotic sex at night. So 21,000 are rooted in redelusion ignorance. 21,000 are rooted in attachment. 21,000 are rooted in aversion. And the fourth 21,000 are rooted in all three. So it's a really coherent map of the mind. I mean, who knew? 3,000 years old, we thought it was Freud who invented clever psychotherapy. No, it was these Indians even before the Buddha. Only now we find this out in the West. That's very fascinating. So now, what's possible to do with compassion? Everything. So if attachment is getting what I want, that's called happiness, we think. And then suffering, the grossest level of suffering is when you don't get what you want, isn't it? So now, if you're going to have compassion, that means for someone who's got suffering. So if you assume suffering is only getting the bad things, then that's the only experience of a person you're going to have compassion for, isn't it? But super limited. In the Four Noble Truths, Buddha's very first teaching, after he got enlightened under his tree or wherever, in Bodh Gaya, he walked a few hours, a few days. He goes there every year now talking, which is a marketing. It's a quick advertisement in the middle of the YouTube. This is a you can't tell the difference. It's the same voice. This is a commercial. For 21 years, 23 years now since the pandemic, we've been leading a pilgrimage to the holy places of Lord Buddha. I've done 20 and I'm still not bored. I love going to these pilgrimages. We're all places where Lord Buddha was born, died, got enlightened, taught. So he taught in Deer Park. It's a lovely place outside of Benares. It's called Varanasi. Not Varanasi. What's that name? What's that famous city? Come on. Where the big river is. Oh, I can't remember. Creek.
I haven't been there yet.
Oh, you have. It's famous. It's the oldest, longest, continuously occupied city on the planet. Is it called Varanasi? Is it Varanasi? I thought it was the spot. Famous. 15 miles from Sarada. I can't believe myself. My grandmother said I'd lose names in the world. I didn't believe her. That's right. And they're all in India. So then Buddha taught this first teaching of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Truths for the Noble One. I don't think the truths are. No, it's truths for the Noble Ones, for those who've found the truth. Facts are per facts. The first is there is suffering. The second is there are causes. The third is you can get rid of suffering and its causes. And the fourth is how to do it. So the first one's crucial because Buddha's got three levels of suffering. The first is the obvious one, and he even calls it the suffering of suffering, in-your-face suffering, when the bad things happen. And when the bad things happen is when the attachment doesn't get what it wants. And what this is telling us is pointing to the second level of truth, the causes. And the causes, the delusions, the neuroses. Two main causes, karma and delusions, and they subsume to the one. So the first one is when the bad things happen. So in the first stage of the practice of the wisdom, we have to know this for ourselves and then be sick of suffering, understand the causes, and then proceed to do the job of getting rid of them. So terrible. Now your eyes are open. Oh my God, they're all in the same room. Look at these crazy things you're being. How can I help? So the first kind of suffering, right now, without that analysis, we see that the little doggies and the few doggies and the few children, I think, are the only ones we have compassion for. Like we talked 2 days ago and yesterday, when we have the four noble truths, the four immeasurable thoughts, equanimity, to say, may all sentient beings not suffer, may, you know, recognizing that they all don't want suffering. So when you have the thought, may they not suffer. Or may be happy. May Mr. Trump be happy. Maybe we get the electric shock hearing that. Because the first response is, he doesn't deserve it. So right now, we wish that others be happy is contingent upon whether they deserve it, which means they do what I want, basically. I mean, it's brutal to say it, but analyze the experience. So it's really self-centered. We should be embarrassed. So this whole point in equanimity is to get yourself out of it and realize everyone wants that feeling. Everyone wants that. So one doesn't want, and then everyone wants to be free of suffering. So first of all, we only want to be free of the first one. So everyone recognizes. But let's look at the second and the third, or especially the second, because this broadens the base of all of our objects of compassion to everyone on the planet. If it's only the first kind, then it'll be those who are being harmed by others or poor or suffering or being terrorized or brutalized, you know. And that's, but they've got to be innocent for us to have compassion. Bad people get hurt, we don't have compassion for them. Ladies do it. If little innocent animals, cute doggy boggies and pussy wussies, millies with pussy wussies, if he's got 2 little pussy wussies.
They do the job.
They do the job, functioning as an object of compassion. They totally fulfill the function. They do. When I was a little one, even when people said, I talk about autistic. When I was a little girl, we had these white cats. Someone threw them over the bush, over the fence, and around them with purple flowers. What are those purple flowers? Morning glory or something?
Yeah.
Bush, yeah. And they found these white pussycats. Well, they were gorgeous, and I loved them. But I like to experiment with things. So I remember experimenting by using the vacuum cleaner to suck up water. I was fascinated by how I suck up the water because I didn't know I had to rip off really the vacuum cleaner. Or I saw my doll and I was fascinated to pull its head off and see the rubber bands as well, the eyes together. I thought that would happen. But I ruined the doll. Well, I put the cat down the toilet. I wasn't trying to be mean. I wanted to see what happened. I was an experimenter. Because I'm seeing it, struggling. I'm not really mean. I'm quite a nice person. But I was fascinated with what happened. It's a bit weird, isn't it? The important thing didn't survive. It didn't go down, it was too mean. I remember it, but I wasn't feeling mean. I wanted to know what happened. Anyway, that was a side story. Okay, all right.
Venerable, that brings up a really big question about we can't feel compassion unless we can recognize suffering.
Precisely. In ourselves.
Well, in anything.
No, first in yourself. No. That's the point of the wisdom of me. If I don't know the suffering of eating bad food.
Or being shoved down the toilet.
Or being shoved down the toilet. Just keep it simple. If I don't know the suffering of eating bad food and I can see fat, obese, unhappy people, I won't recognize it. But as soon as I start learning nutrition, I'm going to every person in the world, I'm going to, oh my God, look at that. And there's a big all this and this. Suddenly I have wisdom and that informs your compassion. That's the point. Right, I've got to come first. I've got to see it myself first. If I didn't know about how, if I was shoved down the toilet in a small hole. But this is what we always do with children. We try to make them, we hit them in the head to make them know how hitting in the head means, but we can't see it because that's what we do. It's very hard to see it myself. Anyway, that's enough. It's true. But anyway, what I'm getting at now, the first kind of suffering is indeed when the bad things happen. Good enough to have at least starting ourselves to at least not want that. Then we will be fine. We'll die a happy death, having not caused it by not being mean to others, and then we'll get a nice future life. Now we go to the deeper level of suffering, which is really hard to see. In fact, it seems cruel and mean of good to see, to think it's like this. So the first one, the simple level of suffering is when the bad things happen. The next suffering for him is called the suffering of change. It sounds kind of boring, but listen to this. It's when the good things happen. This seems so mean. That was what we call happiness, getting what attachment wants. He calls it a subtler, more nuanced level of suffering. That's kind of shocking. So we better understand him, instead of this theory, fundamentalist, you know. What does he mean by that? And this is a hard one. In one sense, it's not hard. We sort of take the whole process for granted. We don't join the dots, you know. This is when we really begin to practice. So a really simple example. So the cause of this one is attachment. This is where the first level of practice is junior school, entry level, grade one. Control the servants of your mind. Control the servants of your anger and attachment. Or control the servants of your anger and attachment and don't harm others. That alleviates future suffering, the gross kind. Now the second level of practice, high school. Now you've subdued your body and speech to some degree. Now you go a bit deeper and you get into the mind where the main cause of suffering is. You've got three causes. The main one gets dealt with later. Don't worry about that. Attachment is now what you have to learn to understand. This is the one we have to understand now. So it's this emotional hunger, dissatisfaction, manipulating, controlling, frantic to get what I want, then believing utterly happiness and joy will come when I get the other edge. The chocolate cake, for example. So now, this is the thing that's so tricky. It does bring happy feelings. Check the last time you ate chocolate cake and your stomach was empty and the cake was good. You've got really happy feelings. So Buddha's not saying you don't get happy feelings. That's for happiness. But the mistake is two things. The mistake is we think the cake is the main cause of it. And second, this is the point he's pointing out, it doesn't last. The happiness doesn't last. But because we know that, we wonder why he's pointing it out. But even more distressing, we know if we analyze our lives, there's never moments of happiness that have lasted. So we kind of know they don't last, but our big problem is we believe they should, and so we get devastated when they don't last. So what does it mean by those happy feelings don't last? They don't just stop being happy feelings. They inexorably, shockingly, before we realize, are transmogrifying, whatever that, I don't know what that word means, I've said it, turning into happy feelings, which is called suffering, the first kind of suffering. So look at this, the process. All the build-up, all the anticipation, suddenly, I'm dissatisfied. Suddenly cake, like a big light turns on, you're so excited. You focus on that. You go, get the cupboard, you want the cake, and you're building up the excitement, building up the anticipation. That's the best part of attachment, is the anticipation, isn't it? So excited, can't wait. On the plate, you can't wait to get it in the mouth. You know which holiday, you know which time to put it in there. You're just sitting looking at it. You've got to get it in here. That's the whole point. Why? Or when the tongue meets the tongue and the rest, this is the point. Happy feelings, pleasant feelings will be triggered. Fact. So now, as you're having that first mouthful, as you're saying, oh, this cake is so divine, and it is delicious, very delicious, the happy feelings are very delicious. So at that moment, simultaneously with recognizing how delicious it is and having the happy feeling, at the same time, attachment, this bottomless pit of neediness, is not, still not satisfied. This happy feeling is not enough. So already, even before you swallow the first mouthful, you're anticipating the next mouthful. Because attachment isn't satisfied. And the fact that Buddha's pointing out, which is what we have to get to see, is it can never be satisfied. It's a bottomless pit. This is the nightmare. So you're anticipating, so exciting, because imagine the next mouthful. But the fact is, this is the best piece of happiness you'll have. It's downhill from there. This is scientific. This is not religious. So then you have the second mouthful. Again, hoping the happiness will come and that you'll be satisfied, fulfilled. But the second mouthful, still attachment is working alongside. It's not happy, so you have the third mouthful. And guess what? Inexorably, inevitably, at some point or other, gradually, before you notice it, the pleasant feelings are going downhill and then becoming unpleasant feelings. Until eventually we have to stop, otherwise you'll vomit. That's what we call happiness in life. This is not mean, it is scientific. Do your analysis and you will see it's true. And all of this experience is contingent upon our believing that it should have changed. That's why I'm devastated. I always quote Nicole Kidman. I love the woman. I read about her, an interview in Vanity Fair 25 years ago when she was with Tom Cruise. And she said, "We will be together until we are 80. Meaning, because she's happy now, marvelous, because her attachment's getting what it wants now, the happy feelings are coming. She assumed they'd last forever. So that even that mouthful of cake, the assumption, you know, is that it's going to last. But it doesn't last, and attachment's not happening anyway because it's always another piece. Try the next moment. So it just takes longer with Tom, you know, for the attachment to fade. Well, it didn't take long. Because in fact, he left her. She said, the next sentence she said was, but if it doesn't last, if we're not together for 80 years, I will be devastated. And she was. Because attachment didn't get what it wanted. So all this is built in. All these are assumptions. We have to unpack them. We have to sort of hear them. So that this, why this is so distressing, because I think we know from our experience since we're born that any happy feelings we have had literally do not last. But we keep frantically hoping they will. So this terrible tension builds up. Terrible, terrible disappointment happens. Then what happens tomorrow? You forget the vomit, you forget feeling stuff, you forget the acid reflux, you forget the constipation. You only try to remember the happy bit in the beginning, the one mouthful, and even that, and hope it'll work tomorrow. So you try again. And Buddha says we've been doing this for eons, bashing our heads against brick walls, trying to get happy. And all he's saying is sweetie pies, petals. The message of you is fine to want happiness. Everybody wants happiness. Nothing wrong with happiness. The more happiness, the better. The more pleasure, the better, as Mummy Issue would say. But he says we're just using the wrong methods. That's it. So what's his method? Because all he's saying is, listen, guys, I found a method that actually can get you happiness, happy feelings that don't change into unhappy feelings. That's all he's telling us. We can't hear it too. It's too distressing. It's way too distressing. So what he's saying is, listen, guys, you think happy feelings are what you get when you get what attachment wants. No, no, no. Happy feelings that won't change into unhappy feelings is what you get when you give up attachment. That's his answer. It's not complicated. It's just the hardest job we ever do because we're jumping. This is the second hardest suffering. So don't forget about it in more abstract. So, if you have that view for yourself, as well as the first kind of suffering, you know you don't want the first kind of suffering. You learn to try not to want the second one, although we're all junkies and it's hard. Then this expands your mind. You go, well, you've got the world. So when you see not just the few people who are being harmed, which are the only ones we have suffering compassion for right now, suddenly you see all the happy people and the beautiful people and the rich people and the famous people and the joyful people and the lovely people. You don't think they're suffering, not for 1 second. But that's something that's even more subtle, more primordial, because it will lead to the suffering of suffering. It's hard to see that initially, but this is the Buddhist analysis. We have to do it properly, using our nobles, you know. First hearing the words and then observing the process in here. And even knowing about the first kind of suffering, so adding to this now the concept of karma, which is a whole kettle of fish, you know, this is really hard for us. But forget even karma. We'll just say we have compassion for everybody. So we've got those people who are suffering at the hands of others, the poor people, the sick people, the tortured people, the rape people. Then we've got all the happy people. So who's left? All the harmers are left. That's the third lot, all the harmers. So what about them? How can we have compassion for them? That's ridiculous. You mean I've got a compassion for Mr. Trump, for potato farms, for the whack of bats? Yes, what it says. So what's the logic there? Well, even without understanding karma, which means they're creating terrible future suffering for themselves, which you get for yourself in the first stage of the process. this, even without thinking about karma. When you can see in your own mind, from your own work in the wisdom wing, that your anger, your depression, your anxiety, your fears, your jealousy, your attachment, your depression, that they are the source of your unbearable pain. Forget the harm you do to others on the basis of these, just knowing your own mind enough to know that they are the source of your pain. The anger itself, the depression itself, the attachment itself, they are nightmarish, painful states of mind. Right there. That's it. When we know that, for this reason alone, we can now include all the harms in our compassion. Because they, can you imagine? Look, we just want to jump a few cakes, God's sake. I've got a friend in Kentucky on death row, and my friend Mitchell with the Buddha says, Rabina, he thinks of torture all the time. Now, we don't know why. I mean, just we think he's evil, should go to hell. You know, the Buddha has an explanation. I guess the explanation is even. Can you imagine being compulsively unable to stop having thoughts of torture all day? We're just sitting eating cake all day. It's about the best we can do. And look how painful that is. Can you imagine being born with a tendency to want to do that? To kill, to torture, to harm, jump on little girls all day. Or jump on big girls all day. What's the difference? I mean, well, we think one's worse than the other is true. Can you imagine a mind being obsessed with all that? Can you imagine a mind being paranoid, schizophrenic, a crazy mind, delusional, imagining on and on? Can you imagine the nightmare of that kind of mind? That's suffering, people. So our pathetic little bits of attachment and anger and neurosis and jealousy and depression and low self-esteem, the nightmare of these is what we have to learn to understand. Lama Zaburuti says, when we have got renunciation, renunciation means when you finally start to realize this suffering and you want to get rid of it, like you're sick of the pain. You've got that renunciation when just the thought of another moment of attachment is so repulsive. It's like being in a septic tank. So the fact is, with this level of mind, this is hard to hear because we don't have that level of subtlety of an analysis of suffering in our modern culture with respect to us. We just don't have it. So this is pretty profound. It's pretty outrageous if it's true, you know. Quite shocking. So way to go. Be humble with ourselves. Be patient. So the thing is, you know, instead of this always the way we are in the world, having this sense of a separate me, we're all acting as if we're saints, the pot calling the kettle black, we know that one. We're always finding fault in other people, criticizing, look at this, look at that, look at the politician, look at these people, look at auntie, look at uncle, look at the boyfriend, look at the husband. Always finding fault. The assumption being, I haven't got that fault. Look at those people, look at those bios. This is one of the worst arrogances we have, yeah. It's if we're innocent saints, if we're saints. So there's a real first step is having this humility to own our own stuff, not only guilt and anger, but have incredible compassion for ourselves. I'm able to bear the pain any longer. It's not moralistic, it's not guilt, it's intelligence. But it takes time, it's quite subtle. It's quite subtle, it takes time. That is the basis for having compassion for others. So one step at a time, people. Time to go home. My gosh, look at this. Questions? Come on. Yes. Her hand always leaps up. Who's that? Who is this?
Karen.
Karen's hand leaps up. Go to that one.
I was just thinking about when you were talking about the cake and liking and disliking and indifference towards objects. And
sentient beings, we're talking more about those three.
Yeah.
Smack me, son. Go on. Yes.
Well, that's right. That's what I was thinking. Because we're looking at people from the point of view of friends, foes, strangers,
that's right.
And get from them.
That's
so
right.
We're treating those people as objects, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good way to say it. Quite literally, that's the point. Quite literally, that's the point. Quite literally. We don't see a human being, we see the object of our needs. So when attachment's really strong, this is why we harm people. Like a junkie will do anything because the attachment's so nightmarish.
Yeah.
So look at us when we're really attached to that cake. the thought that someone else might get it, the social influence, you know. But yes, exactly that's what happened. We objectify, literally objectify sentient beings. It's exactly right. Exactly right. I always remember one example when I was an old lady feminist, and I had a policy of any man dare say something about my very nice chest, when it was a nice chest, and that was back in the 70s when I was living in London. I remember I always made a point of shouting at him, abusing him, insulting him. I just thought, why not? Instead of sitting on a street, and they dared be pointing out my breast or whatever in public, you know. So there's one fellow, I was quite sad, he was older, and he said to me that my chest, I forget, and I shouted at him. He nearly burst into tears, and he said, if you don't want me to say anything, why do you look like that? Now, this is not feminism. That's the objectify. He saw me as an object. He had come immensely down a lot of chapters for girl shapes. We got all of them. My point now, the kind of classic one. So all he saw was this shape, and his attack got excited. So that it was literally, that was the shock. He said, if you don't want me to say anything, why do you look like that? Just yeah. It's yeah. Exactly right. You're yeah. Exactly right, darling. Yes, exactly. That's what
you're talking
about.
That's right. Perfect point. Yes. Venerable, there's a question here from Sid. Mm-hmm. So how do we get rid of pride? Like, I am terrible or I am so wonderful?
Exactly, that's right. First chapter, that's right. You gave a good definition. So pride is an offshoot of attachment and aversion. They all are. They're the two main ones. So they're kind of branch out. So all rooted in the main one. So there's an assumption of an I in the first place. And we either have or got it to some degree, and we don't like to think we've got pride in our culture. We all know, we all like to think we've got low self-esteem, which is the good side. So that one of the key parts of all delusions is they distort, they exaggerate, they make a big picture of real reality. So pride is an over-exaggerated sense of our importance. We don't even think we have it. But let me tell you something. If you get the feeling of I'm nobody and I'm nothing, and most of us feel that, that's because we have pride. So in other words, most of us think, which seems, it is sad, all of the delusions are sad, do not doubt it. But we tend to feel sorry for a person who's got most of esteem, but we not be sorry for a person who's got pride. But it's the flip side. So the assumption behind low self-esteem is, but your pride just got thwarted. You actually can meet up, you see a person over there who's even more happy than you, better than you, thinner than you. So what happens is you get resentful. It's like, how dare they be better than me? Oh, I'm nothing. And then that's the voice. So actually it's the flip side of pride, which means that you have pride. Pride is a problem. If you didn't have pride, you would not suffer those of us being. You wouldn't mind if you got abused or insulted. You kind of, you know, be hurtful, but you wouldn't suffer terribly. And we can see we get shattered every day. And that's why we can't even pick ourselves up from most of this thing. We believe this world. We believe we are nothing. It's the flip side. It's deflated pride. So once you've understood the definition, or how to get rid of it, you listen to the story, and you tell the other story. You argue with it. You argue with it. See, this is how you do it. It takes time. And you said the words pretty well. So whenever you feel, but see, all these delusions are so subtle, Sid, they're all going autopilot. So this is why we have to get concentration, to start to dig down and get super clear and see the thoughts super clear. This just takes time. So when you know the definition and the voice that pride is saying, then you understand the low self-esteem one, then we have to catch them, and then you argue with them. But the low self-esteem one is a major one in our culture because we've got pride. We're resentful. How dare these people be better than me? I'm nobody. It's complete nonsense. It's a complete exaggeration. And so that's the very first one. It's a misconception, is it? You don't agree with it. You're not ugly. You're not hopeless. You're not nothing. It's complete distortion, nonsense, over-exaggerated view. So we have to argue with these conceptual stories. But the clearer this conceptual story is, the more precise you can be, is the more precise you can argue with it. That's the practice, Sid. I'll be communicating, darling. Good. Thank you.
Venerable, yeah. There is a thing in our culture called implied criticism that when you...
Oh, what's that mean?
It's when you praise something because it's got all these qualities, but people experience it as implied criticism.
What's that mean? I'm going to give an example.
Give
an example.
Oh, when you say someone's house looks really great.
Say something to me.
Yeah, your house looks really nice.
That's my first.
And the person... The person standing next to you hears it, therefore my house looks crap.
Oh, nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. But yeah, that's wrong. Because you don't want anybody to have better than us. That's called pride. That's true, isn't it?
It's shocking to hear to be doing nothing with our pride. We all think we're nobody. But being obsessively thinking you're nobody is only because you think you are somebody. And how dare somebody be better than us. Then I find fascinating too, anger and pride are like twins, you know. A teacher says, I think you'd say, either way, I can't remember, the best patience is humility. You check the other way. So humility is not is a valid state of mind, which is a comfortable feeling of who you are. You're content with who you are if you're humble. But we hear that as low self-esteem. So the virtues are spacious and comfortable. The delusions are neurotic and panic-stricken. So low self-esteem is a gross part of our nothing. Humility is content with yourself, and it will come with some confidence. It will come with some confidence. And then low self-esteem is, you know, the flip side of pride. So pride, we think pride is confidence. It's not. Pride comes with humility. Low self-esteem comes with whatever I was saying before, pride. Very interesting. The key to all of this is that the delusions exaggerate. They are distorted. This is the key to hearing the stories. So it's so fascinating. We see the one of low self-esteem is because we love. Because we actually, and it's hard to admit it, but we actually have an inflated sense of who we are, which is why we always look at people, as if you're an innocent person. It's incredible, it's fascinating, all the same. Anyway,
there's one from Alicia who can't unmute because she's at work. Graphic asks, how do we find the line of rejoicing our virtues without becoming arrogant or
exactly. It's tricked all the time. How to be humble but not low self-esteem. How to be content with praise yourself but not be arrogant. It's really tricky because we don't just make this distinction in our modern world. So you've got to be brave enough to learn to, you've got to know to hear the stories, you've got to hear the conceptual thoughts. All these emotions are rooted in the conceptual thoughts. You've got to hear the story that Christ's saying. You've got to hear the story that low self-esteem is saying. So have the courage to delight in your progress, to delight. Of course, it's going to bring you to pride immediately. You just have to catch it. It's just training, that's all. Just training your mind, that's all. Training your mind. So after low self-esteem, which is really on how dare a person be better than me, therefore I'm bad, is to delight in the other person. I'm so happy for you. Your house is beautiful. I'd love, that's what content, that's what humility would be. A humble person is delighted to meet someone who's better than they are. Is delighted to see a better house. Well, tell me your secret. That's what humility is. It's a marvelous quality because they're content with who they are. But you see all the delusions, they're so painful, we're so scaredy-baby and shattered and jagged and little kind of tiny things that are hurt by everything around us, you know, daggers everywhere. We take the whole world personally. Is it? Mm-hmm. Where I think there is.
Tragic comedy.
I know it's time to go home. But I want to say one thing. For me, hang on. The wisdom wing approach is all this nuts and bolts in your own stuff, right? Being your own therapist. It's like the retreat mode. So I find when we live in the world, there's a really good method, not that complicated, but never remember it, to practice the compassion wing, which is knowing about your own mind and learning. So the whole world is like a classroom, it's a workshop. So what I love reading all my newspapers, my magazines, newspapers, iPads, never social media though. I don't even know my passwords, you know. Apparently I'm all social media now. That's Jamie, to me, I'm on social. I'm on TikTok, apparently. He said I've got more TikTok followers in 1 month than a whole year on Instagram. See, other people's questions, they come to me from other people. They're moving. They're very special groups, TikTok people. I don't know who they are, but they're quite different.
They're young people.
I hear that. It's utterly fascinating, the question. So moving, the question of TikTok people. Very fascinating. Anyway, never mind that. What am I saying? Yes, this is my method. I love the outside world, the crazy world. I'm stuck in the middle of it, just in the middle. So I read my iPad. I read all about, especially Americans, Mr. Trump. I mean, the Washington Post had kept track of every lie Mr. Trump told. They had a list of his Pinocchios. There were one Pinocchio lies after five Pinocchio lies. They just kept a list of like 4,722 lies, you know. It was very funny. So the thing is, you look at Mr. Trump as a very obvious person. He's arrogant. He lies. He probably steals. Sounds like cheat on his taxes. Arrogant, angry, hubris, jealousy. You can tick the boxes, isn't it?
So they usually want us to look at Mr. Trump, this evil, shout, yell, scream, go crazy. But how about, this is what I try to do, okay, once a month, try every day. Well, there's lying. I recognize that. There's jealousy. I recognize that. Each one. There's not a single delusion that I can see in Mr. Trump that I don't have myself. So then I say, thank you for showing me how not to be. And suddenly the crazy world becomes a learning for you and you bring it back to yourself and you grow from it instead of going crazy, you know. Then you're going to work out the pattern. Do you understand me? Not complicated. Try it. Then you don't go crazy. Because it's not a single delusion. I might not be a pedophile, but I've got a test. I might not be a thief, but I, you know, you can see these things. They're kind of basic, you know. Of course, some people are worse than others. And the more you see them yourself, the more you have compassion. That makes you see. That's the way you live in the world from the wisdom point of view. You don't lead to compassion yet. That's too advanced. Just get them to remind you this is showing your own mind. Then you become, then it becomes rich for you to practice. If you say that. But end with that, shall we? All right. So I hope you familiarize our minds with a few thoughts. Well, I certainly did, so thank you for coming and talk because I think of me. And maybe one of the 3 or 4 minutes we had a focusing. So let me just say one more thing. The benefit that comes from that meditation, the long-term goal is to have a focused mind. We won't get that really, most of us, because it's kind of without state. But what we will get from it is this: the practicing of stepping out of the head for 3 minutes. The practicing of attempting to stand on the breath, not swim in the thoughts, is that you bring that to bear in your daily life. So whereas once you'd be at the kitchen sink, not noticing your thoughts, only noticing the hubby slurping his tea, Eddie doing the wrong thing, instead of that, you blurt out, you know, instead of that, you also now begin to notice your thoughts deep down, and you grab them before they come out of the mouth. That's the benefit of doing 5 minutes of mindfulness every day, I promise. You start to be your own servants. All right? Okay, people. John Trump, Central, Rinpoche, Makie, Panam, Kiyuchi, Kebanyampa, Mepayam, Wongli, Gondu, Mala Shrokis, may Bodhicitta, this amazing aspiration, which is a culmination of love and compassion, may it grow and grow in the heart. May we achieve it so we can be brave and marvelous and joyful and optimistic.